Joe! Joe! The horse lurched and started toward the front gate. Soon the five riders were lined up behind him. Looking out the gate, Nelson could see Dostum's trail, a narrow, churned-up path heading north. He shouted over his shoulder, "You'd better keep up!" They spurred their horses, and the men rode out the gate. Part 3. Danger Close. Chopchal, Afghanistan. October 20, 2001. Najib Qureshi cursed the Taliban tanks and trucks he saw racing from Mazar-e-Sharif, headed south to attack Nelson and his men. For 7 years during the Taliban's rule in the city, he had lived in daily fear of being arrested and beaten. At age 21, pudgy, witty, and easy to laugh, Najib ran a successful language school on the second floor of a dilapidated office building in downtown Mazar. He had 200 students who trudged up the stairs at all hours to learn English. The Taliban were in constant threat of shutting the place down. They did not want anyone to learn English, the language of infidels. One day Najib got into a fight on a street corner with a Taliban policeman, a member of a unit known as the Ministry for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. Najib had refused to grow a beard, and he didn't keep his hair cut short. The policeman attacked Najib with a riding crop, beating him on the head and shoulders, asking him why he was not a good Muslim. Najib snapped. He hit the Taliban policeman and kept hitting, and he found to his surprise that the man was nothing but a coward who ran away from his roundhouse blows. Afterward, Najib stood on the street, shaking, unable to believe what he had just done. He believed he had just signed his own death warrant. He knew that if he was tortured by the Taliban, he would not walk for a year. His neighbor had been arrested and beaten about his genitals. The man was now paralyzed. Najib ran to his father's house. The terrified man begged him to travel quickly to Pakistan and hide from the Taliban. Najib deeply respected his father, who made a comfortable living for his family by importing radios and kitchen appliances for the few Afghans who could afford these luxuries. He also dabbled in real estate. His pedigree as a former Mujahideen fighter during the long war with the Soviets also gave Najib's family cachet among Mazar citizens. None of that mattered, though, under the Taliban. So Najib left the city. He stayed away for several months, and then crept back, unnoticed. Since that time, 4 years ago, he'd been living a life under siege, but still refused to close his language school. The past month, hearing the news of the attacks in America, he felt a strange kind of joy and sadness. He knew that the Americans would be coming for the Taliban. That night, he crept to his rooftop and erected the makeshift satellite dish he'd bought on the black market. It was made of flattened Pepsi cans that had been duct-taped together to form an elephantine dish, and fitted with parts cannibalized from other defunct rigs. Najib sat up through the night, watching the reports of events unfolding in America. Each morning he had to disassemble the dish and hide it from the Taliban under a tarp. He was filled with a bitterness that he did not like. Suffering had forced Najib to become philosophical at a young age. He knew that if he held terrible thoughts in his heart, he would not have a bright future. If you try to avenge something, he reasoned, it cannot end well. The funny thing, he thought, was no one ever asked the Taliban why they were so cruel. Why were they hurting people and killing them? They thought the only way to live was by their own beliefs. They did not respect village elders, who traditionally had held leadership positions among the people, fixing land disputes and arguments between neighbors. He couldn't help himself. He wanted to kill them all. Nelson hadn't ridden far when he saw the dust cloud of Dostum's posse up ahead, maybe a half mile away. Dostum was keeping ahead of him, out of range. He didn't know why. He worried about losing the trail and pushed hard to catch Dostum. As they rode, they hadn't seen a soul so far. They passed empty settlements that had been decimated by the Taliban. Whole families wiped out. The men and boys dragged away into the army. The water wells poisoned. The shells of houses standing amid mounds of broken mud wherever the Taliban had driven their tanks up and inserted the cannons through the windows and fired. Soon they came to a crossroads. Nelson lifted his hand and brought the men to a halt. He turned. Riding up behind them were 10 Afghan soldiers, Dostum's men, who had left the fort after them. Their security detail. Trailing them were 2 mules, straining under the load of the team's rucksacks. 2 more mules carried bottles filled with water. The bottles hung from wood frames around the withers of the mules. Each mule carried several dozen. The bottles made a dull music against the damp hide of the animals as they trudged. The Afghans passed him on the trail and cut back in and kept riding without stopping. They took the west road to the left, and storms of dust that Nelson and his men rode through. Soon the Americans had lifted their scarves around their mouths and sat breathing through the machine oil smell of the tightly loomed fabric. Some of the Afghan riders tucked a corner of a scarf in their mouths and sucked on them, and as they rode, the scarves darkened downward from their chins. After several more miles, they approached the village of Dehi. Nelson halted the team. "Everybody look sharp. Dostum says we may not be welcome here." The men were nervous and wanted to know what they would do once they rode into town. "Just be ready," said Nelson. "Everybody lock and load. And if you have to shoot, make sure it's for a very good reason. And for God's sake, don't shoot women or children." They saw the first gaggle of people standing at the edge of the village, watching them come on. Men with leathery faces hunched in brown blankets. Others in dark suit coats, standing with hands clasped behind their backs, as if waiting for the doors to open to some invisible building in front of them. The main street was dark as ash. Along its edge, rocks the size of fists. A low hump of gray mountains stood in the distance. Storefronts lined the streets, but Nelson thought, God knows what they are selling. Hitching posts out front, but no horses. The store roofs were low slung and rested on poplar logs stripped of bark and dug by hand into the hard ground. The walkway along the stores was raw planking that ran underfoot, and under the roof swung the skin sides of beef and sheep, twirling slowly like music box figures. From somewhere, a back alley, a cook's smoky fire. They kept riding. They were in 2 columns, about 90 feet apart. Nelson laid his M4 across the saddle, with the barrel pointing at the crowd. He kept one hand on it and waved with the other. At their passing, the villagers parted and reached out filthy hands as the legs of the men brushed past, and they swarmed to refill the emptiness behind them. There was no sign of Dostum anywhere. "These people came to see a parade," said Nelson. "So let's give them one." Now there were at least 200 armed men on each side of the road. Some of the men wore makeshift uniforms, camo pants, and shirts of varying pedigrees from who knew how many different countries. They carried battered AK-47 and RPG tubes. They were an army of cast-offs, soldiering in hand-me-downs. The army the United States had forgotten after the Soviet pullout in 1989, once they were no longer needed to fight the Cold War by proxy. "We're going to need you now," thought Nelson. Some other men in the crowd were working worry beads between calloused forefinger and broad thumb as they recited prayers under their breaths. More men were walking toward them, holding hands. They weren't gay, Nelson knew that. In public, men and women were forbidden to touch, but men could easily show this manner of affection. Nelson thought that they really should just keep moving. He figured the villagers had heard the helicopters land in the night, and they'd come out to meet the Americans. Either that, or Dostum had ridden through town and announced the Americans were on their way. Nelson called out to the team, "Everybody keep a finger on the trigger." Without warning, the security detail ahead pulled up and stopped. Everybody on the team halted, tensed. Diller put his hand on his sidearm and the holster on his leg. Others did the same. "What's going on?" Diller asked.
"I don't know."
Nelson said he'd ask. He spoke in Russian, and one of the riders in the security detail answered that they needed to stop for supplies. Supplies? That sounded dubious. The last place Nelson wanted to be was stuck in the street while the Afghans went inside a store, maybe never to return. The Afghans dismounted and stepped up into the store and went inside. Nelson could hear them talking excitedly to an unseen storekeeper. The villagers pressed around the legs of the horses, looking up at Nelson and the men. "Grip and grin," he told them. He had a few phrases he knew from some pages of Xerox material he'd studied back at K2. He put his hand over his heart and said, "Salam alaikum." The villagers looked back and smiled and said the same. "Chotor asti," said Nelson. "How are you?" "Namatuchiast," he said. "What is your name?" He kept scanning the crowd in the front door of the store. Up ahead, on the left side of the street, there stood an outpost, like a guard shack, built up on one of the roofs. He kept looking at that, too. Still, no sign of Dostum. He'd gone through about all of his phrases, telling the villagers his name, not his real one, and asking if they liked candy and telling them that he was fine, thanks, when the Afghans emerged from the store hauling bags of horse feed over their shoulders and carrying even more water in 5-gallon plastic jugs. "We must be fixing to be gone a long time," thought Nelson, "if we need that much water." The Afghans loaded these items onto the mules, who stood with their knees locked under the weight, trembling. One of the mules would not stand still, and the Afghans beat it with a leather crop fitted into an ornate brass handle. Nelson, and he could tell the guys on the team felt the same way, wanted to say something about beating the animal, but he didn't. His job was to be there and not be there. "You ready?" he called to the Afghans in Russian. They ignored him, but the question seemed to register, because they swung onto their horses and reined them into the middle of the street and started riding. Nelson rode up to them and pointed to a side street between two squat mud homes. Blue and green tarps rested on tree branches at the street's edge. A woman in a blue burqa sat holding a child. Beggars, mother and child. The father probably killed by the Taliban, or hauled off to fight for them. It was like passing by two sundials churning the sun. A silence without end. Nelson cut ahead and took the alley between the two houses. He wanted to get off the main drag and ride hard through the back streets and pick up Dostum's trail. They came out at the other end of town. Before them lay more open ground. Dark rock, piled in jumbled moraines along the valley walls. Nelson pulled up his horse. The other riders stopped. Where is the general? Nelson asked. The Afghans pointed out across the open ground, and then up into the mountains to their left, across the river. It was another 4-hour ride, they said. Nelson looked up. The time was about noon. They had maybe 6 hours of daylight. Nelson realized that he had to admire what Dostum had done. He'd led him and the team through town as a show of force against the Taliban. Nelson guessed the intended message was, "Here are the Americans, and they're not afraid of you. And they are with me." That they hadn't been killed was just a bonus for Dostum. They struck out across the open ground. Wearing his bulky day pack, his load-bearing vest stuffed with ammo clips and grenades and bulging over his stomach, Diller found it was hard to move around much. He could already imagine the formation of saddle sores. In usual Diller fashion, he decided he would ignore the discomfort. They crossed the cold Daryasuf, the horses plunging in and pulling out the other side wet up to their chests, and the men's pants dark up to the knees. The Americans rocked and groaned in the saddles. Diller could feel the bleeding start under him. They rode across a ceramic hard plain and crossed another braid in the river and came out clopping on the other side and started to climb a mountain, or a part of it, a shoulder, hunched 6,000 feet high on the thin bank of the river. They cut in on a trail carved in the rock and started up. The horses put their heads down and didn't lift them. They rode for 15 minutes headed across the mountain on the trail, and then at the trail's end they came to a little cul-de-sac, where the horse had to hitch up in its step and turn and bear the rider forward as they struck back across the mountain, climbing and climbing higher. On one side, to Bill Bennett's right, stood sheer mountain wall, cascading plates of rock frozen in place. To his left, a 1,000-foot drop. He reached his left hand out, and underneath was the airiness of the valley floor, the river twisting below like green wax string. The trail was 2 feet wide. How in hell does this horse know not to step off? The animal ground out each step, the cannon bones in the legs driving like small fence posts on the ground. Ram, ram, ram. They rode up the last bit of the hill, and the horses strained beneath them and stood on flat ground. Nelson looked out from the saddle and beheld a landscape stretching as far as he could see on either side. Miles of hills, tinted red. The air was filled with an ochre dust, swirled up in winds rising miles away. The dust that now settled on him had flown from far away, Nelson guessed, and he looked at the shellacked faces of the men. They sat like monuments in the saddle, stiff and thirsty, barely moving. Dostum was still nowhere in sight. From Kabul, John Walker Lind flew by helicopter to Kunduz, ancient trade post, squalor, thin-lipped boys with sores bearing silver salvers of smoldering incense through the streets. The smoke meant to keep the jinn away, evil spirits that steal men's souls. In the parks, the deranged, men babbling in tongues, out of their minds and with no hospital to hold them, wandering freely in their robes striped with excrement. Men thought to be speaking truths, the sagacity of shamans, seers, standing in a park and shouting under a noon sun, as others went about their work around them. From Kunduz, Lind got on a bus. The dirt road north, swinging and swaying out over the plain, as if constructed in a delirium. At one point the road had been straight. Then came the war, and the planting of landmines. A car, a truck, a tank grinding down the thoroughfare would veer around the presence of a mine or the threat of its presence. And by this way, the road veered like a river seeking least resistance. The road led him to the desolate village of Chichke. The village, or what was left of it after the Taliban siege, lay along the Amu Darya River. He got off the bus dressed in flowing shalwar kameez and his cotton skullcap, a dark rind of beard around his doughy face. "What am I to do?" "You are to walk to that hill and sit. Here is a rifle, a grenade." Lind trudged up the hill. Facing him, the jagged escarpments of the mountains of Tajikistan across the river, rising 10,000 feet. Snow in the valleys, bright sun. The ground gritty under his soft palms as he sat in his trench and waited. Waited for the invasion of the hordes, the infidels, Dostum's men. They were to come from the north, enemies of Afghanistan, enemies of Islam, drinkers, fornicators. There is no God but God, and Allah is his name. It was September 6, 2001. So spoke the voice of God. Nelson sat on the horse and saw that down below the hill there were three trenches. In front of the trenches, facing north, earth had been piled to make protective berms. The trenches were about 30 feet long and 5 feet deep. A man could stand in them up to his waist. He could lean forward over the berm and rest his rifle on the packed earth and fire. Nelson saw that they were soundly made fighting positions. At the top of the hill, he discovered three caves. Dostum emerged from one of them, the largest. He stepped toward Nelson, and with a sweep of his arm said, "Welcome to the mountain headquarters." Behind the hilltop, the rest of the team dismounted from their horses. They slid down from the saddles and stood in their tracks, unmoving, as if frozen in place. Many of the men found they couldn't walk, and some were bent over, as if catching their breath. All except Nelson. The ride had invigorated him. Diller could feel the blood seeping through the seat of his pants. The saddle had rubbed the skin clean away. Nelson called out a few good-natured comments about who looked funny now, and the guys ignored him. They placed their hands at their backs and attempted to stand up straight. As they did, they stifled groans so as not to raise suspicion among the Afghans that they were not good horsemen. The ruse, of course, failed miserably. Diller saw that a few of Dostum's men were sniggering at them. Diller looked over at his horse and promptly named it Dumbass. "Well, Dumbass," he said, "I'm going over to get my ruck off the mules, and when I come back, I hope you're dead." He hobbled over to help the Afghans unburden the exhausted pack animals. Each of them had carried in excess of 300 pounds, maybe more, when the usual load might have been 100. "I would not want to be a mule in Afghanistan," thought Diller. "I would not want to be an Afghan either." Under the direction of Dostum's men, he and the team hauled their rucks across the hill to a cave next to Dostum's. Like his, the opening was set into the side of the mountain, the rock face rising another several hundred feet into a promontory. Diller thought it was not smart to be setting up quarters below such high ground, until he saw the face of an armed Afghan peeking over the edge and looking down at him. He toted the ruck inside and dropped it on the cave floor. The accommodations were more than he expected. The cave had a funny odor, like stacked fur in a dry cleaner's shop. Warm, humid. He could stand up in the middle of the cave with about 4 feet of headroom. From wall to wall, it measured about 25 feet. He looked at the walls more closely. They were covered in a strange substance. Diller reached out and stroked the rough, furry surface. The fur was actually horse dung. Maybe mule, too, he figured. For insulation. The blanket of shit was dry as toast and flaked only slightly to the touch. How the Afghans had ever managed to affix it up there and make it stick, Diller couldn't guess. But he found it a marvel of engineering. As he walked around unpacking his gear, he tried not to brush up against the walls. Outside, Dostum and Nelson sat cross-legged on a red blanket, overlooking the valley. Next to them stood a tall wooden pole with a radio antenna wire fastened to the top. Dostum sat by the radio itself and a bank of portable solar cells that could be broken down and carted by mule. Nelson thought it was a pretty slick setup. Dostum was running this part of the insurgency on solar power. That had to be a first. Nelson guessed their elevation was about 8,000 feet, and that the far hills across the valley were 10 miles away. The hills, like all the hills, looked denuded. The Taliban hadn't been able to take this high ground from Dostum while he'd been battling them in the south, downriver, at Dehi. This had been hard fighting. Because of the area's 3 years of drought, much of the drinking water for his soldiers had to be trucked in and carried to battle on mules. Dostum's men had even dammed the Dar Yusuf to make a pool for their horses to drink from. At night he would gather his fighters around a lantern and, unrolling his map, plan the next day's attack. He spread the soldiers out over several miles in groups of twos and threes to wait an ambush. If they were discovered, their small number would not give away the fact that 500 more men were camped nearby. After a day's fighting, he and his men rode their horses back down rocky trails and picked their way along the river and broke out into a clearing that was their base. They were safe here because the road was non-existent. There was no way for a tank or bimpy to reach them. The Taliban would have to walk or ride horses, and he knew they didn't have horses. An infantry attack in the valley would have been suicidal. Dostum could set up firing positions in the rocks and pick off the enemy as they marched down the river, their long black robes swaying, their guns at the ready. He would have killed them all. Now Dostum was going to use this high ground to bomb them. He despised, most of all, a tall, bearded Taliban commander named Mullah Faisal, the man who now occupied his former headquarters at the fortress in Mazar. Faisal commanded the Taliban's 18th Corps, some 10,000 soldiers, a feared man with a perpetually pinched gaze and an inscrutable smile. Next in command was Mullah Razak, whose 3,000 to 5,000 soldiers of the Taliban 5th Corps controlled the Dar Yusuf and the adjacent Balkh Valley, where they were also battling Atta's men. Razak was joined in the Balkh by the fearsome, one-legged Mullah Dadullah. He'd lost the leg fighting the Soviets and wore a wooden peg as a prosthesis. These three commanders were supported by several dozen sub-commanders spread across the country. Dostum pointed across the valley and said, "There they are, Taliban soldiers." These were Mullah Razak's men. Nelson raised his set of binos and cranked down the focus with his forefinger and steadied himself for a clear picture. The binoculars were heavy and rubber-coated and powerful, but still Nelson couldn't sight any enemy fighters in the distance. He didn't want to say so. It was like hunting deer or catching fish. Part of your standing in camp meant how well you could spot game. You looked for what shouldn't ordinarily be there. He lowered the glasses. I'm sorry, General, but I don't see what you're looking at. Dostum pointed to a far outcropping on one of the distant ridges. My God, that's miles away, Nelson thought. Does he think we can bomb that from here? Okay, I see it, said Nelson, bringing the dark spot into focus. That is the Taliban's position, said Dostum. One of their bunkers. I know, because I have been fighting them. He asked Nelson, can you bomb it? Well, sir, like I said, we can bomb it. But I need to get closer. I can't accurately target it from here. No, said Dostum. You cannot get closer. I cannot let you get killed. 500 of my men can be killed before even one of you is scratched. I know that. I understand that. But you have to understand I can't call in bombs from this distance. I've got to fix the bunker on a map and call that coordinate to the pilot. Dostum's aide, Chari, was translating. Nelson wondered if he was getting it all correctly. Nelson didn't like haggling with Dostum about how to do his job. He wanted to ask him why he'd left them in the lurch back at Dehi. But something stopped him, a feeling he had, that he had passed a test by getting to the mountain headquarters, and there was no sense in asking for the test's reason. To do so might signal that he was uncomfortable with accomplishing the unknown. He thought maybe this argument about dropping bombs was another test. Dostum's men bowed and curtsied to the general's every move, and it was clear that he was the bull of the woods in these parts. Nelson could see how this arrangement would work. Dostum would be in charge, and Nelson would make him believe that this was true. All right, he said. We can drop bombs. I'll set it up. Dostum smiled. This made him very happy. In fact, Dostum was relieved. He had his doubts about the Americans' abilities. He had never seen their bombs. They were reported to fly where you told them to go. By themselves, like iron birds. This technology had not existed in his long war with the Soviets, and then with his fellow Afghans. Otherwise, of course, he would have used it. He was hoping the Americans would surprise him again, as they had last night when they landed so expertly on the small dirt pad in complete darkness. Dostum had thought it was most incredible to fly helicopters at night with no lights. Unbelievable. Nelson asked, "And you're sure these are Taliban, right?" It was Nelson's responsibility not to drop anything on anybody, unless the target was clearly defined as an enemy position. Those were Nelson's rules of engagement. Otherwise, various warlords could use the Americans and their wonder bombs to take out rival factions. Hell, at this distance, Nelson couldn't be sure exactly what he was looking at. But he was determined to find out. The fact that the bunker was so far north, in Taliban-held ground, was one indication it wasn't owned by Mohakik or General Atta, Dostum's arch-rival. But Nelson wanted more. You're sure they're Taliban? Frustrated, Dostum picked up a handheld radio, a Motorola walkie-talkie. Come in, come in, come in, he said, speaking rapidly in Dari. This is General Dostum. The small speaker popped to life. Dostum had raised the Taliban on the radio. Nelson heard shouts and chatter, none of it sounding friendly. I am here with the Americans, Dostum said, and they have come to kill you. What do you think of that? The radio roared even louder, as if that were possible. Dostum smiled. See, he said to Nelson, they are listening to me. Tell me, said Dostum, speaking back into the radio, what is your position? This was unbelievable to Nelson. that Dostum would ask such a question, and that he seemed so sure to expect an answer. Nelson heard the Taliban talk even more rapidly. Dostum turned to Nelson and explained that yes, in fact, the bunker they were looking at was the Taliban's. No doubt about it. And then it dawned on Nelson that the Taliban had no idea what was coming. He had a sickening feeling, elation and fear, that he might get ahead of himself if he got too confident in the fight. The Taliban believed they were invulnerable. This in itself was an incredible discovery. At the moment, he was possibly the only guy on the planet who understood it. Like Dostum, they had never seen what a relatively inexpensive GPS mounted inside a $20,000 bomb could do. The places it could fly. He realized they had never fought a war like this one. Dostum signed off by saying, "Thank you, that is all." He told Nelson that he talked to the Taliban all the time. Some of his men had brothers or cousins in their army, he said, either by choice or conscription. And sometimes these men came to him and asked, "Sir, could we not attack a certain place so strongly today?" "Why?" Dostum would ask. "Because my brother is there. He is a good man. I do not want him killed." And if Dostum could afford it, if the position could be determined to be of some minor importance, Dostum would hold the attack. That was the way war worked, Dostum said. Everything was possible. Forestalling death was a negotiation. He explained that the Taliban had called him on his Motorola after the attacks in the United States. "The Americans will be coming," they told Dostum. "Who will you fight for?" Dostum had laughed. To his mind, the Taliban were fools, ninnies. On top of that, they were boring men. They did not drink. They hated women. They were a social nightmare. He described how a few weeks earlier, he'd even met with some of them in person to discuss the future. Was he worried about being killed? Not really. He knew he was worth more to them alive than dead. In him, they had a known quantity with which to negotiate. A man who would make deals. If they killed him, who knew who might take his place? Perhaps a man like Ustad Atta, who would show no mercy at a critical juncture. A man who is as unbending as a teacher's ruler. "You are a Muslim," the Taliban scolded him. "Don't work with the infidels." They explained that Osama bin Laden himself had proclaimed jihad against the Americans. Dostum squared himself and looked the Taliban leader in the eye. He told them, "Your jihad is useless. Don't come to me with your talk of jihad." He practically spit out the words. He grew angrier. "Even the Muslims hate you. You have committed a crime against humanity that is unforgivable." He asked the Taliban soldiers how many women they had stoned. "Hundreds? Thousands?" he yelled. He wanted the Taliban to feel some sense of shame, but he could see they did not. "Here is what I'm going to do," he told them. "I'm going to do a hometown thing. Pack up your things. Pack your trucks. Leave the north. Leave Mazar-i-Sharif. Go back to where you came from. Don't come face to face with me again. Don't bother me." "That," he said, "is what I will do for you." He went on, "But if you stay and fight, I will kill you. I will hunt you and kill you." The Taliban had been flummoxed by Dostum's bravado. They didn't know what to think. The man did not seem to fear them at all. The wind whipped dust devils up and down the hill, that went spinning into the valley and vanished with a visual pop in the air. Nelson knew it was a fearsome thing he was about to do. He stood at the edge of the trench with his hands on his hips, looking at the valley and the Taliban positions beyond. He jumped down into the trench and landed waist-deep in the narrow slit. The Taliban were on the other side of the river. The river ran north and south, but at this particular place it took a bend to the left or west, so that the Taliban were actually on its north side. Ahead he could see the village of Beshkam about 3 miles away, several dozen mud houses, no people. And beyond that another village, a tiny brown flare on the horizon through the optics of the binoculars. At the sound of the approaching Taliban tanks, the villagers of these various places had scattered into the hills, hiding. Even farther north was Chopchal. If Nelson could push the Taliban north and reach Chopchal, then they could take Baluch. From there, the Taliban would have to fall back up the river to Shulgareh. In this way, they could drive the Taliban north to Mazar-i-Sharif, 40 miles upstream. They would start with Beshkam. One of Dostum's men stepped forward and spread a blanket on the trench berm, and Nelson turned and said, "Tashakur, thank you," and leaned forward with his elbows in the blanket, still looking at the country through the binoculars. He let out a breath and waited for the image to settle and focus before his eyes. A collection of 8 Taliban pickups loomed up in the water-clear depths of the binoculars, looking as if they were only a quarter mile away. Close enough to see the battered black doors. The blink of the windshields, like dusty mirrors. Toyota Hiluxes. In the cramped beds of each, several dozen Taliban soldiers were sitting along the rails, with their robed knees touching in the middle. Rifles over their shoulders. His first clear sight of them. He fiddled with the focus wheel to sharpen the image. Their turbans, black as crow's wings. "We'll have to get closer," he said, hoping the older man would relent. Dostum cut him off. "We will bomb from here." Nelson shrugged. So be it. He had to give it a try. He reached down his shirt front, pulled up the GPS hanging by a lanyard on his neck, and read the pixelated numbers in the gray window of the device. These were the latitude and longitude coordinates that marked his position. He had to shield the small window with his hand to read them in the sun. He read them twice to make sure he was not making a mistake. He wrote the numbers down in a green hardback notebook he kept in an oversized pocket on his shirt sleeve, and circled them to keep them separate from the rest of the numbers he would be writing down. He did not want to mistakenly give them to the pilot, who might confuse his position with the enemy's. Nelson asked Dostum to unroll the huge map, and the anxious warlord did so. "We are here," Nelson said, pointing at their ridgetop on the paper, one of thousands of elevation lines on the map. He reached into his rucksack, lifted his rangefinder to his eyes like a mariner's spyglass, and shot the distance to the pickups. He read the numbers in the scope's reticule and marked them down. They were 8 kilometers, or about 5 miles away. Nelson looked down at the map and counted the grid squares from his ridgetop, until he'd marched out 8 squares with his finger, each grid square equaling 1 kilometer, and found the Taliban's approximate position on the far hill. He set the rangefinder in the dirt beside him and looked up at the position across the valley with the naked eye. Yellow sun, the far hills looking sheared as if by tiny, incessant jaws. The Taliban were dug into the hillside, and their trucks were parked below the bunker, about 100 yards off. A small path led up from the hill and into the mouth of the bunker. The doorway was framed up by thick timbers, with a heavy piece of wood overhead as its lintel. Nelson studied the scene. He wanted to absorb the raw image of it. When he felt he had done so, he looked down at the map and translated the image onto the elevation lines fanned on the paper. He did this several times, looking back and forth between map and hill, until he felt he'd found the position on the paper that corresponded to the features of rock and slope across the valley. He now had a fix on the Taliban's position. He wrote the position's grid coordinates in the notebook and scribbled Enemy CP, Command Post, beside them. These were the numbers that he would radio up to the B-52 overhead. He looked up, squinting. There it was, the jet, miles above, barely visible. It looked like the silver nub on the screen of a child's etch-a-sketch, scoring a wide oval in the sky, about 20 miles long, 10 miles across. The pilots called this the plane's racetrack. The plane was waiting up there. All Nelson had to do was pick up the radio and relay the numbers. He hoped by God that he didn't screw it up. The satellite radio was heavy and boxy like a home stereo receiver, powered by a green battery about the size of a half-gallon ice cream carton. A cable snaked from the radio across the dirt to a black spindly contraption that communications officer Vern Michaels had erected as Nelson plotted the Taliban position. This was the radio's satellite antenna. It was shaped like a small, charred Christmas tree. Michaels had set it in the dirt and carefully pointed the crown at the sky in the direction of government satellites circling overhead. Nelson keyed the mic and identified himself as Tiger 02, his call sign. The pilot came back acknowledging himself as Buick 82 and said he was cleared to drop. Nelson read off the coordinates, and the pilot repeated them back. Up in the cockpit, the pilot reached over with a gloved hand to a console and typed in the numbers. He then pressed send. The coordinates circled backward in the plane through the skeleton of circuits and entered the bomb bay, where they dropped into the bomb and came to rest in the GPS, which was about the size of a paperback novel, strapped inside the bomb near the tail. The bomb awoke. It was now armed. The pilot announced, "Pickle, pickle, pickle," the traditional announcement of bombs away, then pushed another button on the console, and the bomb fell from the belly of the plane and started flying to the ground. 30 seconds, radioed the pilot. Roger, 30 seconds. As the bomb fell, the GPS monitored its position and checked this against its destination. As the bomb rocked and hummed in the slipstream, the GPS sent signals to the tail fins, which feathered the breeze and ruddered the projectile on course. 20 seconds, said the pilot. The bomb was 12 feet long and filled with about 1,200 pounds of explosives. It was tapered at its green nose to a sharp point and could fly 15 miles from drop point to target. It was called a JDAM, short for Joint Direct Attack Munition, but it was known informally among the Americans as a smart bomb, as opposed to the dumb bombs dropped by the millions over Europe and Japan during World War II. 10 seconds, said the pilot. Several weeks earlier, Nelson reflected, he'd been sitting in his car at the Wendy's drive-thru at Fort Campbell, waiting for his order. Oh, Lord God, do not let me miss. Nothing was moving upon the far hills. None of the men in the trench was moving. They were silent. They stared at the Taliban position. And then, the mushroom cloud. They saw the explosion before they heard it. And then came the boom, It came rolling up the hill and over them on the ridgetop like a train, and kept going and receded behind them and faded. The violence was fearsome, scary. Nelson had called in airstrikes before, but never on people. Always in practice. He scanned the Taliban position with the binoculars, anxious to see the damage done. As the smoke cleared, he saw that something had gone wrong. He scanned the hill again. The bomb had missed the bunker. By a lot. Maybe a mile, maybe more. It had landed between them and the target. He wondered if Dostum realized the mistake. He was about to explain what had happened when he noticed that one of the general's most trusted aides, a man named Fakir, was moving up and down the line of Afghan troops, slapping high fives. The men with him were laughing. Dostum himself was grinning. For the moment, Nelson decided that he'd keep his disappointment to himself. As he was thinking this, the second bomb hit. This explosion was even bigger, and Nelson saw that this one, too, had fallen short. The Taliban were filing out of the bunker and looking around, up at the sky and across the desert, unsure of where the big noises were coming from. After a short while, they went back inside. Dostum's men continued laughing at the sight. Nelson was sure he'd figured the coordinates right. Maybe the B-52's crew had plugged them in wrong. He got on the radio and told the pilot to correct for elevation. The pilot dropped again. This third bomb hit closer. Nelson figured it had fallen about 600 feet from the bunker, 2 football fields away. He was going to have to do a whole lot better than this. At the sound of this closer explosion, and with the air still thick with smoke, the Taliban poured out of the bunker, maybe 100 men or more. They came running out in a crouch with their weapons at the ready, as if under infantry attack. As soon as they saw the smoking crater, they stopped. If they saw the B-52 overhead, they didn't seem to connect its presence with the sudden appearance of the 10-foot-deep crater at their feet. Nelson felt like he'd traveled back in time. Here he was, riding a horse, loaded with sophisticated electronic gear, and ordering bombs to be dropped from planes that were flown from Diego Garcia, 2,800 miles away in the Indian Ocean. As the men on the team would later say, this was like the Flintstones were meeting the Jetsons. The Taliban stood puzzled at the crater's edge, and then a few of them started walking around inside the smoking hole, shaking their heads, as if to divine its origin. Nelson was getting madder by the minute. He might as well have been standing on Mars and phoning the war in. They didn't know he was even there. He decided he would recalibrate the drop. Before he could reach the pilot, however, 2 more bombs exploded. These were even farther off target, and landed 2 miles or more from the bunker. Nelson barked into the radio that the pilot should hang fire. He turned to Dostum, ready to apologize. He wanted to say, "That's not who I am. I am capable of more." But he knew this would starkly draw their relationship and make Nelson into a man looking for approval. It would shift an unspoken balance in Dostum's favor. Fakir saw the disappointment in Nelson's face. "Don't worry," he said. "What do you mean?" "You have made explosions come from the sky. The Taliban are afraid." Dostum was speaking happily into his radio with the enemy. "I warned you that I had the Americans here. How do you like me now?" Nelson saw his opening. "Well, I can do a whole lot better than that." Dostum wanted to know how. "Get me closer to those son of a bitches." Dostum wondered what choice he had. He knew he himself didn't know anything about dropping bombs. The young man seemed serious. He liked his aggressiveness. He was tireless, like himself. He announced that he would take him to the Taliban. That night, before turning into bed, they maintained guard duty 2 hours on, 2 hours off. Nelson looked down the hill behind him, where the Afghans were standing beside their horses and removing the saddles. They reached into bags and lifted out what looked like iron nails, measuring at least 2 feet in length. And as they lifted them in the dusk, they looked like men in miniature, handling the tools of giants. They dropped the nails on the ground with a thud, and bent and grabbed them with both hands, and righted them, with the points sticking into the dirt. They hitched their smocks at the knee, and raised a foot to stomp on the blunt end. They then tested the nails by trying to jiggle them back and forth. They unspooled long leather leads, and ran one end through the horse's bridles, and tied the other ends around the mushroomed heads of iron. The horses began walking in circles around these new centers, as the riders rummaged in their meager kits, which looked to Nelson like colorful piles of rags, containing some food, bread, nuts, dried meat, and maybe an extra blouse and a spare shoe. Walking back to the horses, they snapped open feed bags sewn from UN flour sacks, and dropped in handfuls of oats and corn, lifted the sacks up around the horses' muzzles, and reached up and tucked the straps over the ears, and stood back as the horses chewed hungrily, making a muted, wet music inside the steaming burlap. The riders walked up to a campfire and sat on their haunches, eating and staring at the flames. The air smelled cold. The stars drifted up from the horizon, as if loosed from a zoo, and swarmed the dark above them. When they were done, the riders stood and brushed the breadcrumbs from their smocks, and walked down to their horses, talking quietly. They threw their blankets over the animals' withers, and patted their heads and said good night. They walked up the hill to their cave and went inside, and Nelson could hear them talking low, as they lay down shoulder to jowl, uncovered in the cold night. When he realized that they had given their blankets to their horses, Nelson believed that if he fought with the same selflessness, none of them could be beaten, and that he would live. They turned out of the camp at mid-morning, and rode down the hill with the sun hot on their backs, and the horses rolling beneath them along the path. Then the riding got hard, the path rocky. They climbed several thousand feet across the face of the mountain, and descended again, going where there was little sign of a trail, where no truck or tank had ever been. As Dostum rode, Nelson heard him on his satellite phone talking to congressmen back in the United States, politicians in Pakistan and Russia. One of the men he talked to was a hearty character named General Habibullah, who at that moment was fighting in the Taliban army. Habib had, in fact, 40 men under his command, and was dug in a trench in Chapchal, the village Dostum and Nelson were now trying to take. A former general in the Afghan army, the anti-Soviet army, Habib had been imprisoned after the Taliban took power in 1996. His family urged his release by promising that Habib would join the Taliban army. Reluctantly, Habib agreed. What else was there to do? Habib had rented his skills as a soldier for his freedom. He loathed the Taliban. He was one of the select few Dostum had given a phone to in order to communicate secretly about their movements. Mendicants, zealots, misfits, revolutionaries. Much of the Taliban army had dropped through so many hoops and wickets to finally find themselves resting at the bottom of the Taliban trench that their provenance was a lesson in Middle East geopolitics. Their reasons for coming ranged from the absurd to the sublime. One soldier fled his